Hey, welcome everybody. This is lecture 5 for the Mises Academy class offered in the first quarter of 2012 called Mises on Money and Banking, where we go through the theory of money and credit. This is the postponed lecture because I was traveling, so I appreciate everyone adjusting your schedules accordingly. I try not to do that, but sometimes it's unavoidable. And so today we're talking, it's lecture 5, and I tweaked the content. I don't remember what the exact title was in terms of your syllabus, but I'm going to spend a bit of the beginning of today's lecture talking about the quantity theory of money, which I think technically was contained in the reading assigned for lecture 4, but we ran out of time. And so that's a pretty important topic, and so I didn't want to just skip it altogether. So why don't we go ahead and jump right in. Also, let me just acknowledge the PowerPoint for this week's presentation is going to be mostly just quotes pulled from the reading that I just pasted on the PowerPoint, and then I'm going to walk you through it for two reasons. One is that I had to prepare it while I was on the plane, because that's why I couldn't do it on Wednesday, as I was traveling from Canada, and so I was in a plane for 12 hours basically over the last few days, and so it was, without internet, it was easier for me to do it that way. But also, I think that's one of the ways that I can sort of help you guys through this and be effective in adding stuff beyond what you can get just from reading it on your own. Especially if you're pressed for time and you have enough time to take the class and listen to my lectures, but you can't really sit down and read 40 pages a week from Theory of Money and Credit, I'll go through and try to highlight things that are particularly poignant, and so then if you see the original quote, you can see the context in which Mises was saying it, and then if I walk you through it, that's, I hope, a good way for me to make the material more approachable for some of you. Last housekeeping item before we jump right into the content tonight, I am going to have office hours this week, and there is going to be a quiz for week 5 material, but because the lecture got bumped back 2 days, the quiz obviously isn't posted yet because you needed to hear the lecture first. So I will do all that stuff tonight and send out an email, so the quiz will go active Saturday, and then I'll also tell you the exact time of when the office hours will be. So it'll be earlier in the day than it has been thus far because my son's basketball league ended. So anyway, and you'll have a full week. In other words, you're not going to lose time because the quiz gets posted a day late. But anyway, that'll all be spelled out in the email. But just in case you were getting anxious, don't worry. The quiz for this week hasn't been posted yet. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to draw your attention to is this quote from page 125. So let me read it, and then I'll walk you through it. So here's Mises. He says, "To a naive observer, money made out of precious metal was sound money because the piece of precious metal was an intrinsically valuable object, while paper money was bad money because its value is only artificial. But even the layman who holds this opinion accepts the money in the course of business transactions, not for the sake of its industrial use value, but for the sake of its objective exchange value, which depends largely upon its monetary employment." And that's from page 125 of the Mises Institute's PDF version of the book. All right, so there's two reasons I'm drawing your attention to this. First is because that might surprise you to see Mises saying this. And then the second reason is that it's important to see why Mises holds this and how this is, at first glance, is in tension with perhaps your understanding of why Mises supported the gold standard, but it's important to understand the economics behind Mises, what made Mises write this passage, and then I think that'll give you a fuller appreciation for what Mises' views are, what his theory of money is, but then also why then does he support the gold standard if he's saying something like this. Okay, so again, on the face of it, this might have surprised you because I have seen plenty of so-called gold bugs, so people who nowadays are big Ron Paul fans and people who probably, if you just ask them off the top of your head, hey, what, do you like what Mises had to say about gold? they probably say, oh yeah, Mises is awesome. But if you press them, you say, oh, why do you like gold? I think plenty of them would say something along these lines. That, you know, gold is real money. You know, there's an actual commodity there. It's a real thing. And they might even go so far as to say it has intrinsic value as opposed to artificial fiat money, which is just pieces of paper and there's nothing real there. Okay, so like I said, this isn't a straw man. And in fact, I've seen, you know, on the internet and whatever, I've seen plenty of people who are for a gold standard or even, you know, just gold money. Like, forget, because the term gold standard kind of makes it sound like there's a government involved. But people who are anarcho-capitalists saying, oh, in my vision of a free society, everybody would be using gold or silver. And when you ask them, why is that better than what we have right now, many of them would say something along these lines. And so here, you know, Mises is calling that view very naive. And what's the reason? He's saying, well, there's a couple things. He doesn't spell it out right in this particular quotation here, but he does talk about it around this passage in the book, that it's, you can't reconcile such a view with the modern subjective theory of value, that everything ultimately, you know, all value derives from the human mind, right? So there's not, it's not the case that a loaf of bread has intrinsic value because of its, you know, calorific content or whatever, or its objective properties. That value, that was the whole point of the subjective revolution. And that's what overturned the cost of production theory, right? That the classical economists, in terms of their value theory at least, would look at objects exchanging in the marketplace, and let's say one object exchanged for 10 times as much as another one. And how do they explain it? Well, they were trying to think of, come up with an explanation of, well, what is there 10 times as much of in the first object than in the second? And so depending on the economist, you know, maybe they would say labor hours or labor power or something like that, if you were a labor theorist of value. And so that's why the stagecoach traded for 10 chickens, because all things considered in the whole life cycle and everything, you know, all the implements and other complementary factors that went into producing it, it took 10 times as much labor power to make the stagecoach as it did to raise the chicken. And so that's why, at least in the long run, you would expect the market value of the former to be 10 times as high as of the latter, because they were looking at what objective properties are there in those physical things to explain why the one is 10 times as valuable than the other. Just like a physicist, if you're trying to explain, how come when we put the bowling ball on the scale, it reads 100 pounds, or not 100, that's a pretty heavy bowling ball, it reads 25 pounds, and when we put whatever, the feather on the scale, it only reads, I have no idea how much, what, 1/10 of a pound. And they would say, oh, well, because there's that much more mass in the bowling ball, and then gravity acts upon it, blah, blah, blah. But you see, you know, the natural scientists who explain differences in objective measurements of things are going to ultimately refer it back to some intrinsic physical property of the objects. And so the whole point of what Mises is doing in the theory of money and credit thus far in the book is to shatter that viewpoint, to say when it comes to explaining market objective exchange value, you're going down the wrong path if you're trying to figure out what is it objectively in these objects that is proportionally higher in the one than in the other, and that's why the exchange value of the one thing is X times as big as of the other thing. He said, that's just totally wrong. That's qualitatively wrong. All right, so when it comes to money then, similarly, if you're trying to, if you want to say that a gold coin is better money than a paper note because the gold coin is intrinsic, you know, there's something physical there, there's something intrinsic, whereas the paper money is artificial, that's not really a very good explanation, especially if you're trying to link it to an economic theory to explain the value of money, by which you mean its objective exchange value. And so the Mises says, just to prove to you that that's not actually what these people think. You know, they might say that, but then in their course of their daily lives, you will see them selling valuable items, whether they're labor hours or other possessions, for these so-called intrinsically worthless pieces of paper. All right, so that's what Mises is getting at here. He said, so now as economists, if we're trying to understand, well, wait a minute, why are these people, you know, because that is prima facie kind of odd. Why would you work for 8 hours in a factory, or even back then it would have been more than 8 hours? Why would you work and sweat and give up your leisure time for things that, yeah, are intrinsically useless? And it's all because, you know, and I'm just going over old ground here with you guys, but it's because of the expected future purchasing power of those money units. So in that respect, there's nothing categorically different from gold coins versus pieces of paper, right? To the extent that we're treating the gold coins as money and not treating them as things that might be used as, you know, could be turned into jewelry or something, but qua money, the reason people accept gold coins is because of their capacity as a medium of exchange. And so how do they begin to value it? They do it because they anticipate, well, what's the future purchasing power of this going to be? And that's exactly the same procedure they use when evaluating the acquisition of more units of paper money on the margin. Okay, so that's what Mises is getting at here. So now, having said all that, don't misunderstand. Mises is a humongous proponent of the gold standard. I mean, he waxes eloquently, and we'll hit some of that as we go through the course in the remaining weeks we have here, and especially if, I don't think we are officially covering it, but if you read the later essays, right, so I'm pretty sure we are going to stop with this particular class right when we get to the theory of the business cycle, and then we're not going to cover, I can't remember, but anyway, there's plenty of stuff in the theory of money and credit, especially the subsequent essays that he added in the later editions, you know, after the original volume came out or book came out, where you can see how much of a fan of the gold standard Mises is and how much he, you know, it's not merely a matter of economic efficiency. Mises says, and I think this is the quote that the Mises Institute put on the back of the book, something like, to understand the function of the gold standard in terms of the classical liberal suite of policy recommendations. I mean, Mises didn't use those words, but this is what he's getting at. You have to understand the classical liberal supports the gold standard in the same way that he supports a Bill of Rights, all right, that the gold standard, its fundamental contribution to human liberty was that it limited the discretion of government officials, that they just couldn't print money at will because of the, you know, their obligation to redeem the notes with specie. Okay, so obviously Mises is a huge fan of the gold standard, but the point is, it's because it limits the production of new units of the money commodity. It's not because, oh, since it's something real, there's intrinsic value there as opposed to artificial paper money. Okay, this is just sort of goofy, but I thought it was too funny to pass up in case you're not reading it yourself. So on page 125, again, he circles back, and he's hitting this point again where people, where theorists were trying to explain the purchasing power of money merely by reference to its fallback use as an industrial commodity. So, I mean, that was understandable for theorists to do that when the money happened to be an actual commodity that was useful for other things. You know, whereas nowadays, it would be crazy to try to explain the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar or of the euro by reference to its industrial applications. You know, everyone would realize, well, no, there are no industrial applications. It's value out of these euro, but yet it's not. So what's going on? All right, but back then, at least, it was more understandable that people might think that. But anyway, Mises just said to that, the old theories proved unsatisfactory. It was not possible to explain phenomena such as those of the Austrian or Indian currency systems without invoking the assumption that the value of money originates partly in its monetary function. Okay, so again, just to make sure you understand what he's saying, that remember that here he's talking about examples like we talked about last week where the Austrian bank had issued notes that used to be immediately redeemable, I think it was in silver, and then they suspended it and people weren't sure when the redemption was going to be restored. And at the same time, there were just regular bonds issued by the Austrian government, and they obviously yielded interest because they were bonds, whereas the paper notes that used to be money substitutes and now were technically credit money in the Misesian system were not yielding interest, and yet the purchasing power of the credit money was higher than of the government bonds, even though they had the same nominal market value, which is very odd. And so Mises was saying there's no way you can possibly explain that outcome. If your approach to explaining why is it that people were giving up goods and services in exchange for these notes issued by the bank, Mises was saying if you're trying to explain that by saying, well, people are anticipating that at some point in the future the link to silver or gold will be restored, and they're just sort of discounting that, he's saying, well, that's crazy. Then in that case, you know, the bonds are issued by the same entity. So, you know, in terms of creditworthiness, that's not an issue, and the bond is also earning interest. So clearly you should prefer the bond to the money, but you don't. And why is that? And he said, well, it's because the bonds actually aren't circulating as a medium of exchange. And so they don't have that extra desirable feature of that liquidity, whereas the money does. You know, the notes that used to be money substitutes and now are credit money. Okay, so, and then Mises goes on in this quotation here. The naivety of the numerous writings which attacked this opinion that said you had to invoke the monetary function to explain the purchasing power, and their complete freedom from the restraining influence of any sort of knowledge of the theory of value may occasionally lead the economist to regard them as unimportant. And he goes on to say why they're useful as foils to a correct theory. But anyway, I just thought that was funny that Mises describes them as their complete freedom from the restraining influence of any sort of knowledge of the theory of value. So, hence my title, Don't Mess with Mises. Okay, so now we're talking about the famous quantity theory of money. If you have read the chapter or if you read it at some point, you'll see Mises alluding to the fact that this is a very old explanation and it's gone through different iterations. So every generation of economists, in other words, takes the quantity theory of money and sort of recasts it in light of the new, or in light of whatever the cutting edge economic theory is. You know, however economists are explaining other things in terms of economics, they will then, when it comes to money and the price level, and or I should say prices, will take the quantity theory and then just recast it in their modern language or models. And you still see that even well beyond the theory of money and credit. So if you read stuff by Milton Friedman, for example, he subscribed to some variant of the quantity theory of money. All right, so every theorist says, correctly interpreted, you know, I believe in the quantity theory. Well, not everyone, but I'm saying many big gun economists, including Mises, as we'll see, will say, yeah, correctly interpreted, the quantity theory of money is basically correct. But a lot of the previous writers in this genre said things that were silly. Okay, so let's see what Mises says. This comes from page 128 and 29. He says, the proposition was soon formulated that a good, so he's talking about the historical development of the quantity theory of money. So the proposition was soon formulated that a good would rise in price if the available quantity of it diminished. Similarly, the importance of the total volume of transactions in the determination of prices was also realized. Thus, a mechanical theory of price determination was arrived at, the doctrine of supply and demand. Of all explanations of prices, it is the oldest. We cannot dismiss it offhand as erroneous. The only valid objection to it is that it does not go back to the ultimate determinants of prices. It is correct or incorrect according to the content given to the words demand and supply. All right, so there's a lot going on there, but first of all, I just want to underscore, it may surprise you to see Mises saying that supply and demand is the oldest doctrine of price determination. I know that I believed this at some point in my career. I kind of had it in my head that way back when economists used Aristotle or something to explain, you know, they weren't even called economists, they were just social observers or theorists, philosophers, whatever, theologians. And then once economics came into its fore as an independent discipline, then I thought it was the classicals who had a cost of production or a labor theory. And then I thought that was overturned by, you know, Menger and the subjectivists. And then I kind of thought that supply and demand wasn't really codified until the 20th century with Alfred Marshall. But as Mises is saying here, that's wrong, that supply and demand were known before the classical economists. So just be careful, in other words, there's a danger when we try to do a history of economic thought to make it look like people before 1870 were complete idiots. Like when we talk about the diamond water paradox, we sometimes make it sound like Adam Smith had no idea that diamonds had a higher exchange value than water because of relative scarcity. And that, you know, he was just totally clueless. And that's not, I mean, they knew. How can I put it? They were aware of all the same facts that we are. It's just they didn't have a very nimble theoretical framework or conceptual framework to arrange those facts in a nice, coherent, simple way. That they kind of had to reconcile it with their cost of production theory, and so they had this disjointed thing where they said, well, in the long run, the cost of production theory explains how reproducible goods, you know, the anchor of their prices. And in the short term, we've got deviations due to supply and demand, right? They might say something like that. So, and things like Rembrandt paintings or, you know, things that are not reproducible anymore, they clearly, even the classical economists would explain that by reference to what we would call supply and demand. Now, I don't know if they use the term supply and demand, but that's what they were talking about, right? So don't think that the classical economists or even people before them didn't get the idea that, oh, well, gee, if there's more apples that get produced this year, the price of apples is going to be lower. Of course they knew that. Everybody knows that. Anyone who studies markets at all is going to notice that before they come up with more subtle insights. So that's what Mises is saying here, that was the first, you know, those two tendencies were the first things that social scientists, broadly defined, noted about markets, and when it came to explaining price movements, what we now call supply and demand, I mean, they already had that under their belts. And his point, and when he says, you know, we're tempted nowadays from our modern vantage point with all our sophisticated theoretical avenues and what have you, to just dismiss that as erroneous. We say, well, no, it's depending on what you mean by those terms, supply and demand, it's either right or it's not. And then I don't have it in this quote, but he goes on to say, if by supply you are correctly taking into account all of the motivations and incentives and things like that that would govern how much the quantity of items or units brought to the market by the potential suppliers, and if by demand you correctly incorporate everything that motivates potential purchasers, well, then, yeah, then you fully explain everything. But that's kind of where the rub comes in. And so he's saying it's, oh, but what is he, why is he saying it's a mechanical theory? He's saying because even though you might be able to come up with a coherent explanation, you're not really pushing things back too far if you just stop at supply and demand. So if you just say, oh, well, the reason the market clearing price is 10 ounces of gold for this particular thing because we have a supply schedule and we have a demand schedule, and at 10 ounces of gold, that's where the market clears. That is an explanation, but if you haven't pushed it back further and said, well, but what is it that, you know, what are the more fundamental factors that influence or determine that supply schedule? Well, then you haven't really explained it very well. Okay, so now, next slide, we're talking about the historical evolution of the quantity theory of money. So Mises says, quote, it consists in the proposition that the supply of money and the demand for it both affect its value, the value of money. This is probably a sufficiently good hypothesis to explain big changes in prices, but by itself it does not comprise a theory of the value of money. It needs the basis of a general value theory. One after another, the doctrine of supply and demand, the cost of production theory, and the subjective theory of value have had to provide the foundations for the quantity theory. All right, and that quote comes from page 130, and I collapsed the quote when I put the but by in there. I'm skipping a lot of sentences in between. All right, so this is kind of what I was getting at before, that Mises is saying this, the quantity theory of money is very old, and then with each generation of how economists explain relative exchange values, for commodity against commodity in direct exchange, then they take the insight of the quantity theory of money and try to just express it in those concepts or in that language that they have used for explaining barter prices. So back when they just had supply and demand, that's how they couched the quantity theory. But then when the classical economists sort of won the day, and their cost of production theory of barter exchange value was the dominant one, well, then at that point, the people who expounded a quantity theory of money to explain the absolute money prices, not just relative exchange ratios, they tended to use the concepts and language of the cost of production theory of value to express the insights of the quantity theory. And then finally, people who are versed now in the post-1871 subjective margin of utility theory of value, likewise, they can talk about the quantity theory of money from that perspective. So, again, just to make sure you get the big picture here, what Mises is trying to do in this whole book, particularly the first half of it, is he's trying to take the Mengerian approach to economic value per se and just apply it to this specific case of money. And so Menger gave a general framework of how do you explain in the marketplace why this commodity A, one unit of it trades for 10 units of commodity B. And Menger can give a very nice, coherent story as to why that's the case, pushing things back to, ultimately, the subjective ordinal preference rankings of everybody in the marketplace. And so all Mises is really doing in this book is, or at least the first half, is taking that general framework of value theory, subjective value theory, and then applying it to the special case of money, because when it comes to deploying that theoretical approach in the case of money, there are some extra pitfalls or some stumbling blocks that deterred earlier theorists, that earlier theorists got scared off and said, oh yeah, Menger's approach is good when it comes to a barter situation, but when it comes to money, you end up walking around in a circle, or you get to an infinite regress, and so we're not going to go down that path. And so what Mises is doing is showing, no, it's okay. It's a little bit trickier, but the Mengerian approach does make sense with money, and so we're just, we're taking a general theory of value. We're not having two separate value theories, is the point. All the theoretical tools and concepts we use to explain value in general also work when it comes to money. It's just as economists, we have to give a little bit more explanation for why people value money subjectively, whereas with everything else, as economists, we can just take that as a given. But we can't with money, because clearly people value money for economic reasons. And so the economist has to elaborate a little bit more on why is it that the fifth unit of the money commodity ranks at such and such a place on my value scale, whereas if the fifth unit of eggs ranks at that place on my value scale, the economist doesn't have to explain why. You can just say it does. Who cares why? Okay. All right, why don't we keep going here. So, slide C now. So then what is the, as modern subjective value theorists, what is it that we can learn from the quantity theory? Or rather, if we were going to use the quantity theory, what would we want to distill out of it, assuming that we have a correct modern subjective value theory in general? So Mises says, the idea that a connection exists between variations in the value of money on the one hand and variations in the relations between the demand for money and the supply of it on the other hand constitutes that core of truth in the theory, meaning the quantity theory of money. It contains the correct expression of what is valuable in the quantity theory and usable as a cornerstone for a theory of the value of money. Beyond this proposition, the quantity theory can provide us with nothing. And that's from page 130. So in particular, so let me just make sure you get what this is saying. So changes in the value of money, and again, remember, when we talk about value of money, what we typically mean is it's objective exchange value, because that drives everything else. That's what we're trying to explain. And so what, so Mises is saying variations in the objective exchange value of money go hand in hand with variations in the relations between the demand for money and the supply of it. So what it means, for example, is if the demand for money goes up more than the supply of money goes up, then the value of money goes up, which means prices go down, right? If the value of one unit of money goes up, that means a given unit of money trades for more stuff in the market, which means the unit, so flip it the other way, the money price of something goes down, because now money buys more stuff. Money commands more in exchange. That only can happen if sticker prices in terms of money units go down. So, and that makes sense. If the demand for money goes, if people increase their demand to hold money more than the quantity of money, the supply of money goes up, then that means the value of a given unit of money goes up. And with all this stuff, if you ever get mixed up, do it with some other commodity first and get your bearings straight. So think of it in terms of apples. If the demand for apples goes up more than the supply, what happens? Well, the price goes up and so does the quantity. And so with the same thing with money, well, what does it mean to say the price of money goes up? Well, that means the purchasing power goes up, and then that means all the prices of everything else quartered in money go down. So that's the only real hitch with money, is that the price of money is like the reciprocal of the price of everything else quartered in money. But having said that, that's really it, is what Mises' point is here. You can't, for example, go further and make some sort of statement about quantitative changes. You can't say if the supply of money doubles while the demand stays the same, then all prices double. That's not necessarily true. And in fact, in practice, that won't be true. Whereas, you know, some earlier expositions of the quantity theory of money might have said something that naive. So you just have to be careful. Okay, next slide. Slide 4 talks about the equation of exchange. So here, this is the famous MV equals PT, or sometimes you'll see it expressed as MV equals PQ. So this is still used today. And we'll see that Mises is not a fan. So here's a quote from Mises. It was thought that the demand for money in an economic community was determined by the total quantity of commodities that had to be paid for during a given period, and on the other hand, by the velocity of circulation of the money. There is an error in the very starting point of this way of regarding the matter. So he's not just saying there's a mistake in the application. He's just saying to even start down this path is wrong, methodologically. So why is that? Well, he continues. It is inadmissible to begin with the demand for money of the community. For individual economic agents, it is impossible to make use of the formula, and then he's to make use of the formula total volume of transactions divided by the velocity of circulation. And that's from pages 131 to 132. All right, so it's, how can I put it? There's different ways of criticizing somebody's approach to explaining economic phenomena. And what Mises is saying here is that when he looks at theorists who are trying to explain the purchasing power of money by reference to this very aggregative macro, what's called nowadays the equation of exchange, where you, let me just make sure you guys understand what this thing is. So I'll type it in the chat box here. So you'll see use of it. It's like M times V equals P. Nowadays you might see times P times Q or P times Y. And historically it used to be P times T, which is actually more defensible. So the idea is M is the quantity of money. V is the velocity of circulation, meaning how many times during the time period in question, on average, does a given unit of money change hands. So M times that means how many total times does a unit of money, whether it's a dollar or a euro or an ounce of gold, get spent. That's one way of thinking about it. And not just spending on consumption, but in any purchase at all. So that it's also, well, never mind, I was going to say it was nominal GDP, but it's not. It's broader than nominal GDP. And then it equals P times T. So P is the average price level, so the, you know, the price of a generic good or service. And then T is the number of total transactions that occurred. So you can see why MV has to equal PT. It's just an accounting identity. That MV is how much money is spent, and PT is how much money is received. Now, in different versions of it, Q refers to real output, somebody's asking me. And so that's actually more of a simplification. I mean, that's not, they actually don't work, how can I put it? MV would be larger than P times Q. The only way you get MV equals PQ is if you restrict V to mean how many times does the average dollar bill change hands to be purchasing real output. Okay, and so let me just spend a minute or two clarifying that. Because think of it, in general, just N times V, if you're looking at, okay, there's, whatever, $3 trillion out there in the economy total. Like, at any given moment, boom, this second, how many dollar bills exist? And if we're, you know, if we're talking about M1, let's say, I don't remember the exact number is, let's say it's 2 to 3 trillion. So we're adding up how many actual green pieces of paper, and we're adding up everybody's checking account balances, and we can say that right now, as of this second, how many dollar bills are in the public's possession, in that sense, you could give a number. And then you say, okay, on average, this today, how often are those things going to change hands in a transaction? Well, then that would include everything from an employer giving a paycheck to an employee, but it also would include if I buy a house, or if I buy shares of corporate stock, or if I go into the bond market and buy secondhand, you know, on the secondary market and buy bonds that were issued 10 years ago. So a lot of, you know, those transactions that I said there at the end, that's not real output. If somebody has 100 shares of stock XYZ that went public 10 years ago and hasn't issued any new shares since, so that's just, you know, old stock, used stock, as it were. And so if somebody sells me those at $10 a share, so I give them $1,000, well, in terms of the T, that's a transaction, so those dollar bills changed hands, but that didn't make real output go up. There was nothing physically produced. It's not that there were more goods and services because somebody handed me over 100 shares of stock and I handed over them to them $1,000 bills, you see? So, but technically M times V would include that transaction if V means how many times on average does a dollar bill change hands in this economy in the time period in question. So that's what I mean, that originally MV was equal to P times T, where T stood for total number of transactions. So but then because that's kind of a useless, nobody really cares about, you know, oh, gee, did the total number of transactions go up last year? Nobody cares. What people care about is real output. It was more stuff produced last year compared to the year before. Because that's what we would call, you know, real growth, real economic growth, GDP growth. So that's why economists, you know, switch to MV equals PQ, or sometimes they call it PY, where Y is just the same thing as real output. But then, like I say, technically, if you're going to do that, then the V you're using has to be different. It's not just the average turnover of a dollar bill. It's the average turnover in a transaction involving the purchase of real goods or services. Okay. And the only reason I'm stressing that is I never had anybody really point that out to me. I kind of had to just discover it on my own, and then when I brought that objection up, people who use this equation were like, well, yeah, of course it means that. How did you not know that? And well, because nobody ever said it. All right. But anyway, back to the point here. Mises is – so there's different ways you could critique that. But what Mises is saying right off the bat is that's just – methodologically, that's a bad way to approach economics. That you can't, what we're trying to do in economics is explain things according to methodological individualism. Right? That we're trying to explain, you know, with Menger, for example, and how do we explain prices? Well, we start with individuals and their subjective valuations, and then we can step-by-step build up the processes of equilibrium price determination, built on micro foundations, if you will. Whereas economists, when they use the equation of exchange to try to explain money, sorry, let me just say one last thing about that just so you see how it's used. So if you understand, okay, MV equals PQ, then an economist might say something like, okay, so if the Fed comes in or the ECB comes in and increases M by 10%, then what do we know has to happen? Well, if V stays the same, right? So if we assume for the moment that the central bank's increase in the quantity of money doesn't make V fall proportionately, well, then we know that whole left-hand side is bigger. We know N times V is bigger. So then that means the right-hand side has to be bigger. So we know P times Q has to go up because these are, you know, this is an accounting identity. The left-hand side has to be equal to the right-hand side. So then the question is, how does that happen? Does P go up or does Q go up or do they both go up? And so then you can just talk about, and so if you're a Keynesian and you think the economy right now is in a liquidity trap, or there's an output gap, let's say, you know, you might come up with a story as to why boosting M could conceivably raise Q and not P. But once we hit full employment, if you keep raising M, the Keynesian might say, well, now Q can't go up anymore because we're at full employment. So now further increases in M are just going to lead to increases in P. So once you're at full employment, there's no point in the central bank issuing new money, because that would just make prices go up with no kick in terms of real consumption or investment. But if we're originally in a situation of less than full employment, then maybe increasing M will lead to Q going up, which is a good thing, because then we'll get more employment and real output will be higher, so there'll be a higher standard of living. All right, so that's the way this sort of equation of the equation of exchange could be used. So it's not enough to, so you could still tell whatever macro story you want to tell. So an Austrian economist can tell their story and put it in the language of MB equals PQ if they want, or a market monetarist, or, you know, whatever. But Mises's point is that's just not a very fruitful approach, because what you're doing is you're trying to, like, take everybody's individual subjective decisions and just squish them together into this big aggregative framework that there's no such thing as the community's demand for money except the summation of the individual demands. And furthermore, it's not like anybody in the community needs to know what the velocity of circulation is in order to act. So the Mises' point here is, if we're going to actually explain the outcome, we first of all have to disaggregate it, and we have to explain the demand to hold money by every individual. And none of these individuals needs to know these artificial concepts that we're constructing, so then why do we need it at all? We can explain everything just by reference to these individual decisions that we then put together to come up with the aggregate outcome. And at no point do we need to, in our explanation, invoke concepts such as the total volume of transactions, which in any event, I mean, those are such artificial concepts anyway. And Rothbard spends a lot of time in Man, Economy, and State. If you took that class with me, or if you read it on your own, you can see that Rothbard really hits that angle pretty hard, right? That it's not like, how can I put it? To define some of those terms in that equation, you can only define it in terms of the other variables, right? So when somebody asks you, what do you mean by P? It's the average price. Well, what the heck does that mean? You know, because you've got the price of eggs and you've got the price of chickens and the price of automobiles. So how do you average those together to get one scalar number? To get, you know, what's the price per good if you've got all these heterogeneous goods? And so, you know, just conceptually, you know, really all you mean is, if I had the other three, so really what I mean by P is P equals MV divided by Q. That if I took, you know, the total expenditures and divided by the quantity of real output, then that number is the price per unit of real output, and that's what I mean by P. But then you say, what then do you mean by real output? Like the economy in practice, we know for the period in question produced 17,000 chickens and 42,000 eggs. and 16 cars and 14 tractors and blah, 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 blah. You know, you listed these million and one heterogeneous goods and the quantity of each one. And then I say, what is the single number for total real output? What does that even mean? Ultimately, you'd say, well, it's MV divided by P. Right? And that's really what you mean. Because, you know, so that's kind of what Rothbard's point was, is that if you gave me any three of these variables, I could define the other one, but actually two of them are kind of nonsense. All right. Let's move on here. Hang on a second. Let me just skip through these to see what... Okay. So I want to pace myself. So I will be able to have time at the end for your questions. Okay, so now we're on slide 5 here, talking about local differences in the value of money. All right, Mises, on page 170, makes a very interesting point. He says that, in here I'm paraphrasing, this isn't an exact quote, says that the value of money, unlike that of other goods, is not dependent on its actual location because of modern developments and techniques such as the issuing of notes, the existence of clearing systems, and things like that. Okay, so he says something, it's a really cool passage. He says something like, if we disregard certain frictions, generally speaking, it would work. The whole world could use gold as money. And all of that gold could be stored in the vaults in the Bank of England. And everybody around the world could actually be using that gold as their money in day-to-day transactions because they would have, for example, you know, there could be a commercial bank in Brazil that has claims, you know, money substitutes issued by the Bank of England saying at any given time if that commercial bank in Brazil wanted to get bars of gold, they could just send those notes in to the Bank of England and then they would put it on the next boat or the next ship head for Brazil. And so economically speaking, it's like, you know, people treat that Brazilian commercial bank as if it has gold on hand. And then that bank in turn can issue money substitutes. So people can do business, have a checking account with that local commercial bank in Brazil, the Brazilian merchants and the Brazilian shoppers can all be writing checks denominated, if they want, in ounces of gold, even though the gold all physically on planet Earth is stored in the vaults in England somewhere. And that would work. And especially with, you know, clearing systems where people in Brazil might do a lot of business with people in England, but they wouldn't have to keep shipping lots of gold back and forth because just periodically the clearing system would cancel out the mutual claims. And, you know, so that's the way they would do that to minimize how much physical gold actually had to get shipped around because it's very costly. You know, that's inefficient if you can just cancel out the reciprocal claims and then only ship the net difference every once in a while. That obviously economizes on the use of the physical gold. Okay, so that's what Mises is talking about there. And he said that is only because of the peculiar nature of money that it can perform its services even if it's not physically present. Just people being able to exchange claims against money, that allows money to perform its functions even if the money is not present. And so that was the whole point originally in the beginning of the book where Mises almost like philosophically talks about money substitutes and how that's a very interesting thing that if you have a claim to the actual money commodity and the claim is accepted by just about everybody in the community is being payable on demand and there's no, for all intents and purposes, no doubt about the ability of the issuer to repay, then that claim is accepted as money itself. And remember, Mises just says for theoretical reasons, which are going to have to do with his theory of the business cycle, he doesn't want to just call that money. He wants to call it a money substitute. But the point is, that claim itself now circulates in the community as a medium of exchange. So that's an interesting thing about money, that perfectly safe and immediately payable claims to the money can function as if it were the money itself, even though it's not. And so that gives rise to this possibility that Mises says, in theory, money sitting in one spot on planet Earth can be performing monetary functions all over the world. And he says, that's not true of anything else. So then he gives a cool example. He says, there's no way that coffee in Brazil can perform the same functions as coffee in Europe. It's the two are very intertwined. In order to produce the consumer good coffee in Europe, you need to have access to the producer good, or the capital good, coffee in Brazil. And then you combine that with the complementary factors of production like cargo ship from Brazil headed to Europe and so forth, and labor needed to load the coffee in Brazil onto the ships that are on their way to Europe, and the labor to steer the ship and what have you. All right, so you see how all that works? But he says, with money, that's not really necessary. The money that's sitting in England is effectively, is economically just as potent as money that's physically located in Brazil, at least for a large class of cases. Mises does say that there are exceptions where, you know, people might want to actually hold the physical gold in their pockets and not use the money substitutes, and then obviously you would need the physical metal. Okay, so that's kind of a neat little thing there. And then he says later on, and this is an exact quote, the purchasing power of money is the same everywhere, only the commodities offered are not the same. They differ in a quality that is economically significant, the position and space of the place at which they are ready for consumption. That's from page 176. So to answer the question that I put on the title of this slide, I titled it Local Differences in Value of Money? Mises is going to say no. Absent, you know, institutional barriers and things like that, that if market forces are left to play themselves out, money has the same purchasing power everywhere, you know, geographically it can go. Just because, suppose it didn't. Suppose it really were the case that a unit of money could buy more goods in city A than it could in city B, well then the owners of money would move their money units from B to A. Why would you buy anything in city B if that money could get you more in city A? Now, if you can start to think through that and come up with an answer. You say, oh no, wait a minute. If I'm living in New York City and I want to buy a sandwich at the local gas station or deli, and I just walk into the thing, and, you know, not a fancy restaurant, it's a sandwich that's on the shelf in like a convenience store, that could cost me $7. And I know, I was just in New York, and I was shocked at how much the stuff cost there. Whereas if I did the same thing in wherever, in Indianapolis, the same sandwich might only cost me $4. And so if you interpreted Mises to be saying, well, that can't happen, so therefore the guy in New York should just use his dollars to go buy sandwiches in Indianapolis, you say, well, but I wouldn't, because a sandwich in Indianapolis is not as useful to me when I'm in New York. And Mises would say, yeah, exactly. So his point is, the solution to that, I mean, we all understand the phenomenon, and Mises is just saying it's very confusing to describe that by saying the purchasing power of money is higher in Indianapolis than it is in Manhattan. And he says, no, that's not the right way to do it. He says, the purchasing power of money is the same, or at least there's a tendency in equilibrium for it to be the same. He said, the reason you get these long-run, huge gaps in the official dollar price of what appears to be the same physical sandwich or other kind of commodity in the one city versus the other is that economically they're not the same goods. That to the consumer in Manhattan, the deli sandwich that's right in front of his face is a more valuable good than the same physical thing that's located in Indianapolis. Or if for no other reason than if he's hungry and wants to eat it, the one in front of his face, he can eat right then, whereas if he used the $4 to buy the sandwich that's located in Indianapolis, he can't eat it yet. He would have to arrange for it to be shipped to him, or he would have to go himself out to Indianapolis before he could eat it. And so again, just repeating the point, Mises is saying the way to describe that is not to say the purchasing power of money is lower in Manhattan than it is in other U.S. cities. Rather, the way to describe it is to say there are different goods, and it happens to be the case that a lot of those goods have a higher dollar price or money price in Manhattan than they do elsewhere. And Mises has a couple of real good reductio ad absurdums, if you will, for that line of thinking. And he said, look, if you're going to try to explain those sorts of things by talking about the purchasing power of money, and he said, well, okay, let's look at if there's a ski resort. You know, you go to the vacation in the Alps, and the lodge, you know, the hotel or whatever, the resort that's at the bottom of the mountain charges a certain amount, whereas the resort that's at the top of the mountain charges a higher amount, you know, per night that you stay there. And Mises says, clearly the way to explain it is to say for the tourists, staying at the top of the mountain is a different good, a more valuable good, and that's why they pay more for it. Because, you know, there's a nicer view, it's more secluded, and, you know, if you want to ski, you're right there, you don't have to ride the lift up and everything. And he said, it would be crazy to describe that situation by saying the purchasing power of money is inversely related to the altitude of where the, you know, skiers are staying on the mountain. That as you go higher on the mountain, the purchasing power of money goes down, and that's why prices go up. So that's crazy. Clearly, what's going on there is it's a different good. People are willing to pay more to stay at the top of the mountain. So if you get it in that context, then it's not as obvious, but it's the same principle to understand why a sandwich or watching a movie in the theater has a higher dollar price in Manhattan than it does in Indianapolis. Okay. Now we're on slide 6, trade balances, another quote from Mises. Classical political economy demonstrated that international movements of money are not consequences of the state of trade, that they constitute not the effect, but the cause of a favorable or unfavorable trade balance. The precious metals are distributed among individuals and hence among nations according to the extent and intensity of their demands for money. No individual and no nation need fear at any time to have less money than it needs. That's from page 182. Okay, this is a very interesting line of argument, and let me talk about this for a little bit. Like I said, I definitely want to stay on time tonight, and so at 45 after, I'll stop the official lecture and switch to fielding your guys' questions. So let me say some words about this. I'm trying to think. I have a bunch of Mises daily articles on international trade, capital account surpluses, things like that. If you're interested in this stuff, you can go back through my archives and try to grab, you know, you'll see the titles of the articles will be suggestive. So it will say stuff like, is there a libertarian case against free trade? And then, you know, if you find that one, it'll have links to my other ones. Because what happened is I was arguing with Paul Craig Roberts about 5 or 6 years ago when he was just on the warpath talking about outsourcing and stuff like that. So this is where a lot of this stuff comes into play. Unfortunately, the worst mistake I ever made in print is also in there, that where I took on Peter Schiff and said he was wrong. And in my defense, this specific article by him that I was critiquing, he did have an invalid argument. He was saying the U.S. has a huge trade deficit and therefore we're dead. And I was, you know, saying that's not a good argument. I think we're going to be fine. And of course, things weren't fine. So in retrospect, I look like an idiot. But the point is, I still say, you know, that particular argument he was using wasn't quite right. But in any event, you know how that goes. So anyway, what I'm talking about is this gets very subtle, because there's differences between a trade deficit versus a current account deficit. And there's also a major difference if you, how can I put it? Let's say you're pretty good and you're up to speed with those sorts of things. And you, like, if you're the sort of person who knows what I mean by the distinction between a current account deficit versus a trade deficit in the modern context with fiat money, just be careful, because those things don't translate perfectly back to the time when nations were using gold. Because there, you could, it would make sense to just ship gold from one nation to another. And so then the issue is, well, is that an export, or what is it? You know, get what I'm saying? So it's tricky. Or, you know, or is that a capital? So if France buys a million ounces of gold worth of sweaters from England, and England buys 999,000 ounces of gold worth of wine from France, so now the French have to send a thousand ounces of gold on net to the English. It gets a little bit weird. Like, how do you account for that? Do you call it? Is it that the English are investing in French assets, right? Because they now acquired 1,000 more units of money, and that's a financial asset. Or do you just call it a? Or did the French export more? You know, because if the French owned a bunch of gold mines, and that was what they did, they just, you know, brought gold up. You know, like, if they brought coal up to the surface and sold it abroad, that would clearly be an export. So you could argue, well, I mean, they mine gold and bring it to the surface, and they sell it abroad in exchange for sweaters from England. So that's, you know, that's not a trade deficit. What are you talking about? They're trading metal for sweaters. And it just so happens the metal is what we use as money. You get what I'm saying? So it gets, you can kind of get tripped up, whereas some of those concepts actually are easier to see when we're using fiat money. But in any event, I'm giving you, with this class right now, I'm not going to get into that stuff. I'm just warning you in case you are pretty good and up to speed with some of those subtleties when it comes to fiat money. Just be careful. And I think I even spell this out in the study guide. So just look for that sort of thing in the study guide if you want to see more specifics about what I'm talking about. But I'm just giving you right now, guys, a general warning. The way economists talk about trade deficits and trade balances and so forth were different back then, because it was possible for one nation to settle up with another by shipping gold, whereas with fiat money, that's not. Whatever, you know, that doesn't happen, or at least they treat it differently, put it that way. Okay, but anyway, back to this quote from Mises. So the more down to earth, big picture explanation here. What's he talking about? So he's saying the economists of his day, many of them, and especially the politicians and the general public, when they talked about so-called favorable, unfavorable trade balance, the way they pictured it, and this, of course, went back to the mercantilist view, was to say, our nation is buying more stuff from foreigners than we're selling to them, and because we have that unfavorable trade balance or trade deficit, we're being drained of our precious money stock because the way you ultimately make up for the fact that you're buying more of their stuff than they're buying of your stuff is you ship them gold. And so that, and so if you're worried about that, then you might say, okay, so we should put taxes on exports, or we should subsidize, or sorry, taxes on imports, or we should subsidize our export industries to try to sell more stuff to foreigners so we can get some of that gold coming back into our borders. All right, so that was classical mercantilism, that the point is you're trying to influence the trade flows so that you end up accumulating gold or silver. And so Mises is saying I think all of you guys have heard the standard arguments for free trade or against protectionism. But what Mises here is talking about something a little bit subtler than probably many of those arguments that you've already heard, like from Bastiat or whatever. Here Mises is saying what classical political economy did was to show that mercantilist view flipped cause and effect. That instead of saying, as the mercantilists did, the mercantilists were saying, people in France and England decide on how many sweaters and how many bottles of wine they want, and then money has to flow on net between the nations to settle up. So if it just so happens that the English want to buy more wine from France than the French want to buy sweaters from England, and when we say more or less, we mean summing up all the total purchases at the money prices, and then what's the total monetary figure of the one versus the other. Whatever's higher, then the country with the trade deficit has to settle up by sending money for the balance. And Mises is saying what the classical economists like Adam Smith and Ricardo showed, John Stuart Mill, was that you could flip the causality. And instead what you could say is what if instead you pictured the French and the English citizens deciding, like looking at their own cash balances and saying, uh-oh, I'm getting low on gold, so I better not spend as much because my household is losing gold. And then if you do it like that, you could say, okay, what if the French collectively want to, so if every single individual in France feels like acquiring more physical gold in his cash balances, and at the same time, every single individual in England feels like, oh, I have too much gold right now, I'm going to buy some more stuff. Well, the only way those two things can be true simultaneously, if we ignore the other countries, is if gold on net flows from England to France. But how can that be? What, the English aren't just going to hand over gold for nothing. Oh, the French are going to have to send them some surplus wine in exchange. And that would induce the English to be willing to give them the gold. And then everybody is happy. You see how that works? So now what's interesting is Mises is making it sound like that's the right way to think about it, whereas I think it's more correct to just say people make all those decisions on various margins, right? So just like it would be wrong to say people first decide how much stuff am I going to buy, and then they just alter their cash balances accordingly to accommodate those decisions. I think Mises swings too far the other way if he suggests that people just decide, what am I going to do with my cash balances? And now, given that I've made that decision first, consequently, what has to happen with my purchasing decisions to hit that target? I think it's more a combination. Just, you can see that with his last sentence here where he says, no individual and no nation need fear at any time to have less money than it needs. Well, that isn't really – well, there's a sense in which that's totally true at the individual level, and there's a sense in which that's nonsense. Right? There are plenty of people who might you know, if you said to them, hey, do you ever need to worry about on a given month having less money than you need for all your purchases that month? Plenty of people would say, yeah, I got laid off. I'm worried about that all the time. Am I going to be able to pay my rent next month? Am I going to be able to pay the utility bill? Am I going to have enough money to meet those expenses that I'm would be very devastated if I couldn't pay? And so I think it's the same thing with international trade, that if the world price of oil jumps up to $500 a barrel because there's a war with Iran, yeah, it's true that American motorists don't need to worry about money disappearing from their wallets without them voluntarily handing it over, but if they still want to drive to work and gasoline goes up to $20 a gallon, that's certainly going to impact them, right? So anyway, the important point here is I want you to understand the different perspectives of cause and effect that Mises is getting at, but then I am sort of giving a commentary on that to say I think whether he means to or not, Mises here might be flipping the pendulum too far the other way and making it look like the correct way to think about it is that people decide on their money balances first, and then as an afterthought, they figure out what are we going to buy and spend, or how much are we going to spend on stuff, or what things are we going to buy given that we've decided this with regard to how much money we want to hold. And I don't think that's right. I think you factor in everything when you come up with your decisions as to what to buy and how much to save and so forth. Okay, last thing, and then I'll switch to your questions. Slide 7, it's a quote from Mises from page 188. He says, "He who cares to go to the trouble of demonstrating the uselessness of index numbers for monetary theory and the concrete tasks of monetary policy will be able to select a good proportion of his weapons from the writings of the very men who invented them." All right, so what Mises is getting at here, he does acknowledge that for certain general purposes, sure, these index numbers to gauge the purchasing power of the monetary unit are fine. And when it comes to looking at the disastrous consequences of the German hyperinflation, for example, obviously you would be a fool to say, well, we don't know if the purchasing power of the mark changed, you know, in the 1920s in Germany. Of course it did. Of course it went way down. But what Mises is getting at here is it's those tools are not, it's not analogous to, say, a physicist measuring the charge on an electron. It's not that the theorist can use these measurements of the purchasing power of money or the value of money, the objective exchange value of money, in order to develop monetary theory. And it's the fundamental problem that he points out, not in this quote but near it, is that when you go to measure something, that presupposes that the thing you're using is fixed. So if you're talking about length, and you say, oh, we're going to measure length in terms of meters, well, that presupposes that there's this thing called a meter that at least conceptually is of a fixed length, and then you can lay it end to end against something. Again, maybe you can't do it in practice. If you want to say, what is the diameter of the sun, you don't really mean that you have to go out in a spaceship and take a meter stick and lay it end to end a trillion times against the sun. But you can have, you know, conceptually it makes sense to say, what if in principle we did do that? All right. Whereas when it comes to monetary theory, there is no fixed unit of measurement, because even the monetary unit doesn't work. Because, or at least for the thing that we want to specify, right? Because, yeah, you could say you could just measure everything in terms of the monetary unit, but then you wouldn't. What happens if the monetary unit, you know, if they double the amount of money? Well, that's going to change things. But even if they don't, even if they keep the quantity of money fixed, it could just so happen that people, for some reason, the demand for money goes down, and that would also reduce the purchasing power of the monetary unit. So when it comes to economic value, there always is this interaction with subjective valuation, whereas you don't have that in the natural sciences. it doesn't matter what I personally think about a meter stick in order to coherently talk about measuring the diameter of the sun. So yes, there are practical obstacles involved in the measurement of the sun, and you could even get real fancy and talk about relativistic effects. And then, well, gee, if I'm going, if I'm in an inertial reference frame that's going at 0.999 times the speed of light, then the diameter of the sun might look foreshortened or something as I'm zipping by, whatever. But even there, you can still talk about the quantitative adjustments to make to this fundamental notion of length, whereas things are qualitatively more ephemeral when it comes to subjective value. And so there, it doesn't work to say, oh, let's measure the value of money, because ultimately it's always going to involve people's subjective valuations. Okay, let me now, in the last 10 minutes here, pull up, see if you guys have any questions for this week. Just bear with me as I bring it up. Okay, Matt Gilliland, or posting on behalf of Vaughn Kraft, says, this is the only one, so I'll just, it's a three-part question, so that's fine, since we have time, so I'll just use this to exhaust our remaining time. Okay, so he says, hello, Dr. M. So far, since we've been learning about the Austrians, Mises and Rothbard especially, I would like to know if I'm grasping the broader picture. One, the Austrians approached the science of economics as a social science similar to the science of sociology. The Austrians used praxeology as their method to discover the qualitative differences of utility or their ordinal rankings as an example. Okay, so why don't I stop and answer each of these? And so there's three things that Vaughn is asking, so let me answer them in turn. Okay. For sure, yes, the Austrians approach the science of economics as a social science. When you say similar to the science of sociology, that's a more dubious claim, because, yeah, I think Mises would say, done properly, sociology is a social science, almost by definition. If anything is a social science, it's got to be sociology. But the actual practicing sociologists, I think, try to copy the methods of the natural science to scientists, and so Mises might, in practice, not like what the sociologists do with their field. Okay, I don't know. I would have to go and refresh my memory, but I'm just saying, be careful with that part of your clause. I'm not sure. Different Austrians would probably either say what you said is true or false. So what is true is Mises and Rothbardians following him, and followers of Hans Hoppe and so forth. Mises has this broad view of the science of human action, and that's what praxeology is. And then within praxeology, you have a branch of it that's economics proper. Okay, so economics is a subset of praxeology. So praxeology is the science of human action. And so what does that mean, the science of human action? Well, it is the scientific study of all of the implications of the fact that, or of the axiom that, humans act. And what do we mean by saying humans act? We mean that they behave purposefully. So it's not merely that human beings move their bodies around, it's that we are going to interpret some of their bodily movements as intentional behavior. So we're positing that there is a mind governing that bodily movement, and that's why we're going to classify it as an action. So if someone's walking down the street and then there's this big boom and the person goes like this and flinches, you might not call that an action. That might just be a reflex. But if I go up to somebody and say, hey, you know what? Don't look now, but there's an assassin standing behind you and he's got a gun pointed at your head, so I really think you should duck. And then the person goes like that. Well, that's an action. Because clearly there the person's mind was involved and he went like that because he consciously chose to try to use a means to achieve the end of avoiding getting shot in the back of the head. Whereas when there's the unexpected loud boom and the person flinched, that might not have been a conscious choice. That could have just been, you know, his nervous system kicking in. All right, so praxeology is all the logical deductions that you can spin off of the insight, or you could call it the assumption if you wanted, that a lot of what we observe as movements of human beings' bodies is actually guided by their conscious intention to achieve ends that they subjectively hold. Okay, and then so once you go down that path, then you can deduce stuff like preference rankings or ordinal. Because if what you're trying to do is to understand why someone did one thing and not another, all you can really say is the person preferred to do the one action versus the other. So he got more utility from doing the one versus the other. But you can't say he got 16% more utility. Because all it could be is the person did the one thing versus the other, so it's just a more or a less. Okay. Part two of Vaughn's question. The Chicago School, or the Keynesians, approached the science of economics as a natural science, similar to the science of physics. The Chicago School and Keynesians used math or mathematical models to discover the quantitative differences of utility or their cardinal rankings, for example. Okay, the first part for sure I agree with, that the Chicago School and the Keynesians think that there's nothing in principle different between what they're doing and what the physicists do. It's just the nature of their subject matter is different, and so those techniques might not be as effective, but I think, yeah, in terms of their methodological writings, they ultimately would say what we do is the same thing as the natural scientists. So we come up with a hypothesis to explain the observed data, and the better theory bubbles to the surface based on how well it can explain the facts. And so there's a role for experimental observations and what have you. And any sort of quibble you could come up with that sort of naive second grade version of the scientific method actually could be applied to chemistry and physics too. So in practice, it's not really the case the physicists just throw out a theory if there's an experiment that contradicts it, right? I mean, they will say, well, maybe there's experimental error, and then they also care about the elegance of a theory, even though in principle that shouldn't matter. So, but yeah, I think you're right that they don't think that there's anything qualitatively different about economics that would require you to use a whole different approach, a scientific approach, compared to what the physicists do, where the Austrians think, yeah, there is a qualitative difference. Now, but the second part of your question about cardinal rankings of utility, you got to be more careful there. Yes, in practice, mainstream economists use cardinal utility functions. They use them all over the place. in their models. However, if they really know what they're doing and they've studied what would be called utility theory, they could be a lot more nuanced than you might think. And they might say, for example, in standard textbooks, if you go to a top-ranked graduate program, they will teach you in standard micro consumer theory that people have ordinal preference relations and that you don't need to assume that there's any such thing as a unit of utility. Right? So I don't have time to get into it now, but I'm warning you about that. If you want to see some of it, Brian Kaplan touches on this point in his famous Why I'm Not an Austrian Economist. And then I touch on it. I'm trying to think of what it's called. Shoot. If you Google Robert Murphy, ordinal utility, Guido Hulsman, you'll probably find it. It's at Mises.org somewhere. It wasn't a Mises Daily. It was like a note that I wrote that they kind of didn't know what to do with it, so they just kind of posted it. So there's a URL with it, but it's not like it is anywhere. Okay, last thing. But anyway, so there I just walk through what the it's called something like divided preferences. So if you Google Robert Murphy divided preferences and maybe put the word ordinal in there, that should be enough to get you on the front page or first page of Google Hits. So I go through what the mainstream does and show that they actually don't believe in cardinal utility, or at least their theory doesn't commit them to believing in it. Okay, we're already over time at this point, so let me hurry up and answer this last part of your question. Up until now, has praxeology basically been a lost science? Why is it so difficult for the mainstream economists to see that math has literally nothing to do with the study of economics? You say that most mainstream economists agree with the subjective theory of value. However, doesn't the very term subjective imply that one's mind is therefore thinking and eventually acting? Are these scholars so hidebound to their school of thought that they refuse to see how their approach is pseudoscience? What do you think is the primary reason which enables them to cling to such illogical reasoning? So the easy part first. Yes, they believe in the subjective theory of value, meaning they ultimately would explain market equilibrium, market prices by reference to subjective preferences held by consumers. I mean, they would say, oh, it interacts with the objective technologies that the producers have and resource constraints, blah, blah, blah. But strictly speaking, so does the Baumwerkian explanation involves that stuff. It's just the way you philosophically classify it. But it's the same basic explanation. So they're not objective value theorists the way Adam Smith was. But so then why do they use cardinal utility functions, and why do they think that economics should still be an empirical quantitative science? Well, because they still think there's a lot more in economics besides simply, here, let me pause for a second. How do I want to say that? Well, for example, if it comes to something like, does government stimulus spending help an economy that's got high unemployment? You ask, Paul Krugman, and you ask Robert Barrow to debate that question. I think both of them, so Krugman is obviously one who thinks that, yes, Barrow is going to be a lot more reserved in his answer, but I think both of them are going to say, as scientists, we can't answer that question just sitting in our chair thinking about it. We need to go out and look at the real world, because that's an empirical question. In practice, is there a tendency to speed economic recovery when the government runs a big budget deficit, especially if it spends it on, roads and bridges and stuff like that? And so I think both of them, both the Keynesian and the more free market Chicago school kind of guy, would say that that's an empirical question that we can only settle by looking at the data. So you come along and say, oh, but consumer preferences are subjective, and in principle they could change from day to day. I think both Krugman and Barrow would say, or, you know, Eugene Fama or whatever big gun Chicago school guy you want to come up with, would say, and by the way, I don't think Barrow teaches at Chicago, so I don't know if he's even a Chicago economist. But I think they would say, sure, but chances are consumer preferences aren't going to be wildly bouncing around day to day. But if other things equal, let's say consumer preferences stay the same, we should be able, the economists, to answer the question, does government deficit spending help or hurt? And to do that, we can't just sit around and reason A implies B implies C. We got to go look at the data. And we have to be careful about how do we frame the question, and we want to make sure there's not selection bias, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, that's an empirical question that we're going to settle the same way physicists might argue over string theory. They can't solve that philosophically. They have to go smash atoms together in the particle accelerator and see what happens, or whatever. Go point telescopes and look at black holes and things like that, because they don't know what the answer is a priori. So I think that's what Krugman and Chicago school guys would say. And so, yeah, they could acknowledge, sure, preferences are subjective, but there's a lot more to economics than just noting that fact, I think they would say. And yeah, you're right. Any quantitative measurement of something like the elasticity of substitution or the multiplier on government deficit spending, but whatever, it's true. The fundamentals could change, and then that would change the number. But if it just means the multiplier went from 2.07 down to 1.84, it's still a positive multiplier, and it still makes sense to run a deficit. You see what I'm saying? I think that's probably how they would answer it. Okay, well, I need to stop there. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Sorry to steal your Friday night from you, depending on what your time zone is. And I will send out an email tonight posting the information about when the office hours will be tomorrow and about your quiz. Okay. Thanks, everybody.